There is this thing.
Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, July 15th. My name is Joel Salmadal, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Ganyagahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Le Festival Nuit d'Afrique, the rendezvous of world music, invites you to the 36th edition from the 12th to the 24th of July in Montreal. Do not miss one of Brazil's most amazing vocalists, Fabiana Coza, the pillars of Jinawi tradition, Mukhtar Ghania, and Jinawa Soul. The electric blues of the fabulous Don Tyler Watson. Live moments of pure beauty with a South African performance by Derek Gripper and the griot of Corazal Kisisoko. For the full program and tickets, go to festivalnuitdafrique.com.
First news. Grenadian Montrealers are demanding the city for answers after a suspected case of racial profiling. Last month, 15 police officers appeared at a barbecue outside Green's restaurant in Lachine. They included members of the Eclipse Squad, who specialized in organized crime. This was in response to a noise complaint at 8:30 p.m. on Jean-Baptiste Day, Quebec's national holiday. And on Sunday, Kanagawage's Echo of a Proud Nation powwow returned after a two-year hiatus. This year's event was one of the best attended, with around 8,000 people. Kanagawage held its first powwow in 1990 after the Oka crisis. The largest in Quebec, it remains a symbol of Mohawk resistance to settler colonialism. And on Tuesday, the Quebec government agreed to give the First Nation of Anishinaabe its own regional police force. The new unit will be made of Indigenous patrol officers and replace the provincial force. This comes after more than 15 years of negotiations and concerns about slow response times from provincial officers. And as of Thursday, doctors in Quebec can prescribe the abortion pill as long as they feel qualified. In the past, doctors were required to complete a specific in-person training program to perform medical and surgical abortions. This policy change comes after at least 300 Quebec doctors signed an open letter demanding the removal of restrictions surrounding abortion pill access. And on Thursday, Health Canada approved Moderna's vaccine for children between 6 months and 5 years old. This is the first vaccine approved for that age group in Canada. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM.
Whose data? Our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
Welcome Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5. My name is Joel Salmadal. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we'll be sharing the air with the Final Straw radio podcast. We'll listen to a discussion with Dr. Sophie Lewis about the current American political climate with its attack on trans people and deferring reproductive abilities. She'll explain how that intersects with LGBT education, abortion access, and more. We'll see you at the top of the hour.
On Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Jalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from struggles for liberation from all around the world. Welcome.
Hello. On today's show, William and I talk with Sophie Lewis, author of Full Surrogacy Now and the soon-to-be-released Abolish the Family, about the current political moment that is characterized by attacks against trans people and people's reproductive abilities. We think about what creates this moment where trans people are coming into the target of state power being weaponized by the far right. We also think about the connections among these attacks against LGBT education, access to transition, access to abortion, and critical race theory. We think about the limitations of a legalized framework around abortion as opposed to decriminalization. We think about the limits of liberalism, particularly liberal feminism. We also talk about the ways that certain strands of feminism have contributed to an anti-trans discourse. In our discussion, we think about how we might approach supporting people who need access to healthcare, whether it's transition or abortion, outside of the hands of the state.
One really quick announcement.
To all networks of Rise Up for Rojava, to all friends of the Rojava Revolution, and to all comrades who are fighting against fascism. Today, on the 7th July 2022, the Autonomous Administration declared a general state of emergency for all regions of northeastern Syria. Over the last weeks, attacks of the Turkish state on all front lines in Rojava, consisting of ground and air assaults and massive artillery bombings of the region, have increased intensively. At the same time, on a daily basis, comrades and civilians are being targeted and killed by drone strikes. Since the latest NATO meeting in Madrid, it became clear that the NATO and its main actors, the US, Germany, Great Britain, France and Italy, gave the green light to Turkey for a new invasion of Rojava, northern Syria. At the moment, the situation is getting more intense day by day. The Turkish army and Turkish mercenaries are mobilizing on the border, heavy weapons are brought to the border, and huge military convoys are sent to the region. We cannot exactly say when the situation will escalate, but one thing is clear. The escalation is imminent. We have to understand what this means. In a few days, we will celebrate the 10th anniversary of the revolution. 10 years ago, on the 19th July 2012, the people of Kobani took their destiny into their hands, liberated their land, and started off the Rojava revolution. Since then, the people of Rojava, under most difficult circumstances and with huge sacrifices, have built up their life and land with their bare hands. This revolution created a revival of internationalism in the 21st century, and it created a reality of struggle which is an inspiration to all of us. All the achievements of the last 10 years are right now at risk. A new invasion by Turkey into Rojava will either mean the end of the socialist project Rojava, or it will become the reason for Turkish fascism to collapse. The region here will either be thrown into an age of darkness, or the sun of freedom will rise high and shine its hope into the horizon, into four directions of the world. For this reason, we call on everybody to understand the seriousness of the situation and to prepare according to this. Send your solidarity to Rojava on the 19th July. Prepare for Day X. Build local Rise Up for Rojava initiatives and get creative by yourself. Together we stand against NATO. Together we will smash Turkish fascism. Together we will defend the revolution, and together we rise up for Rojava. We say to you, Serkevdin, and we send you our revolutionary and respectful greetings from Rojava.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Sophie, for coming onto the show. I'm super excited that you're here. Would you, just to get us started, introduce yourself with your name, correct gender pronouns, if you wish, and speak a bit about what you do and what your interests are?
Yes. Thanks so much for having me on. So my name is Sophie Lewis. I'm a they, she pronouns person. I'm a writer living in Philadelphia since 2017. I also teach courses on critical theory online at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. And I'm also a recovering or ex-academic. I've sort of got British and German dual, you know, nationality, but I grew up in France. I'm very sort of placeless in my background, and I'm trying to make Philly home in a meaningful way. What else about me? I recently heard someone say that quote unquote sort of small C communists are just anarchists that went to grad school. And I felt sort of read to filth by that, not gonna lie. I am interested in anti-work theory, unorthodox Marxisms, and critical utopianism. I'm interested in trans, disability, and health liberation frameworks. I'm interested in reproductive justice. And I'm interested in the destruction of propertarian kinship. And I share with my beautiful partner, Vicky Osterweil, who I believe is a friend of your show, mm-hmm. a strong interest in film and literature. So, like, I've never seen a dumb heteronormative reality TV show I don't want to, you know, wax theoretical about.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm so excited to talk to you. And yeah, I just like your views and analysis on things are always like super insightful and helpful to me. So I'm really glad that you're willing to come talk to us.
I'm very flattered. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And I know that we are going to ask for another interview with you about your work on like abolishing the like nuclear family unit as we know about, but would you speak a little bit about some of your past work as well as like some influences that you have or inspirations you had when writing or conceptualizing those works?
Yes, great. So my work in the past is kind of varied. You know, it's funny, the thing that some people nowadays associate with me the most, i.e. more so than my book that you mentioned, is my essay My Octopus Girlfriend, which is mm-hmm. to say I got in trouble on social media a couple of years ago for my feelings concerning the queerness of octopuses. And we can talk about that another time if you want. But I do think it's interesting to bring this up partly because my kind of more than human commitments and my commitments to the erotic do seem to be one of the reasons why there's plenty of people in the normie left, mm-hmm. so-called, you know, at least online, who consider me in this moment of sort of red-brown triangulation, you know, in so many words, a degenerate, right? A degenerate. But anyhow, in 2019, I guess Full Surrogacy Now was published by Verso Books in 2019. And that book loosely represented my PhD, which, by the way, was in geography. And what the hell is geography anyway? At the University of Manchester in England. I think geography is like a place for all the odds and ends and ragtag sort of misfits of academia and humanities disciplines end up if they want to be kind of abolitionists or anarchists or Marxists. Anyway, so it's called Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family. And to be honest, I don't think Verso Books or I expected anyone to read it, and things did turn out kind of differently. It's not a book as they finally understood around the time that the paperback came out 2 years later about the service or arrangement commonly known as surrogacy. Mm-hmm. So much as it is a family abolitionist manifesto sort of for gestators. But that part about family abolition was a cause of, you know, much interest. And so in October, I have a sort of clarifying follow-up about that part of the politics. Yeah, coming out. It's very short. It's called Abolish the Family, a Manifesto for Care and Liberation. Also with Verso or Salvage editions. And I clarify, yeah, this family abolition component. And especially, I extend its sort of anti-racist dimensions a lot more. So I'm excited to talk to you about that in a future episode. In general, I guess I write a lot about reproduction and critical utopianism, which is why my handle is ReproUtopia. Although I guess once upon a time, I thought that that would be some kind of professional handle, whereas my rabble-rousing one would remain at LastSophus or whatever, but I can't split myself that way. I just can't do it, which is probably one of the reasons why I don't have a job. Sometimes I think I'm not even sure I believe in reproduction because, you know, maybe there's no such thing. Maybe there's only, you know, co-generative co-production. But you get the idea. I sort of write against private property. I write against biogenetic property, I write against eugenics, I hope, and against patriarchal motherhood, the private nuclear household, and the privatization of care. I guess you might sort of be interested to hear that I cut my teeth politically doing climate justice, direct action, and sort of anti-austerity student stuff while I was an undergrad between 2007 in 2011, I was hanging out with anarchists and anarcho-feminists in the UK. And after that point, I was quite traumatized by getting beaten up by riot cops in Copenhagen, where we were mobilizing for climate justice at COP15. And I became really sort of unable to think about climate individually or you know, or write about it. So instead, I'm part of a collective called Out of the Woods, which is not very active right now, but which published a book called Hope Against Hope, Writings on Ecological Crisis with Common Notions Press. And basically, it's only when I'm being with them that I can sort of bear to think about, you know, eco-side sort of head on, you know? Also asked about my influences. I'm sorry, this is running long, but I'd say my big theoretic influences include decolonial and ecological sort of sex radicals like Kim Tolbear and Angela Willey. And then obviously family abolitionists like the inventor of the word feminism, Charles Fourier, or, you know, Charles Fourier, the 19th century French socialist utopian. And, you know, the left Bolshevik, Alexandra Kollontai. And then, I don't know, sex worker liberationists like Femi Babylon and Amber Hollibaugh, and anti-work philosophers like Kathy Weeks and Tiffany Letabo King, and, you know, problematic faves like Shulamith Firestone, you know, the early Donna Haraway. I guess what I'm just listing all my favorites. The, you know, insurgent social reproduction theorists, basically. I'm thinking like Frances Beale of the Third World Women's Alliance, or like the women of Black Women for Wages for Housework and Wages Due Lesbians in the 70s. I do visit the 70s quite a lot. And at this point, I've written a ton of essays for magazines and journals since I'm trying to earn my living as a freelancer. Albeit I wouldn't be making ends meet if I didn't also teach. And I wouldn't be making ends meet if 250 people didn't kindly sort of patronize me to the tune of, yeah, I think I'm about, yeah, I get $1,000 a month on Patreon. That's kind of my only dependable source of income.
Hell so yeah.
Thank you to people who do that.
That's lovely. And we'll probably ask you for how people can support you on Patreon at the end of the show, or if you want to say it now.
Oh, bless you. Yeah, it's patreon.com/reproutopia. I appreciate it.
Hell yeah. You said you draw a lot from the 70s, and I think the 70s just gave us so much emergent kind of thought, you know, crafting. I listened to an interview that you gave on This Is Hell, that podcast in which you mentioned friend of the show, the novel Woman on the Edge of Time, which I was like really sparked by and like very interested to, like, maybe we'll save that as a teaser for our discussion on abolishing the family and such topics. But yeah. Scott, if you want to say what you were saying then.
I'm really excited about the way that you're picking up on some of those legacies from the radical movements then. And one of the things that you just said that maybe is what I'm hoping could, like, kind of roll into the discussion and something that we can talk about is your intervention seems to be within what is called in feminism, like, social reproduction theory. But I like how you were, like, kind of backing away from that term and talking about, you know, co-generative and, like, thinking about how I think when we talk about social reproduction, we get caught in, like, reproducing the same over and over again. And I really like thinking about how the things that we do right now maybe can stop that endless repetition. But it does seem to be, like, what is on the sort of, like, on the hook right now is, like, what kind of world is being reproduced, or can we end that? And is it going to be ended in a good way or a really scary way?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So
very much agree.
Maybe we can transition to just the point of our current discussion, though I'm excited for the future one, is thinking about what's happening in this moment socially, legislatively, with ramping up of attacks on trans people and on reproductive self-determination. So, like, just as a way to kind of get into it, why do you think this is happening right now? What created the conditions for trans people to be under target, youth in particular, and weaponized by the far right? And why is this the moment that, like, finally, you know, like, we're seeing the kind of culmination of decades of work against abortion?
Yeah, really great opening question, albeit, you know, quite difficult. I'll do my best. I'm thinking about the process of sort of hollowing out of the political center that we've been sort of seeing, I think, for some time. And the sort of hollowing out of the center creates conditions, I think, in which marginalized groups can be flung kind of sacrificially under the bus. And, you know, this is sort of complicated, but it seems to me that because of the extraordinary success of, to some extent, right? I mean, you know, of Black Lives Matter, there is, I think that the establishment wants to sort of, it's not like they ever, you know, had to choose one or the other, or, you know, as though white supremacy isn't, like, still part of the DNA of every, you know, political maneuver by the ruling class in this country. But I think there is a sort of pivot towards the sort of sex panic specifically. And again, just to be clear, it's always racialized at the same time. But I think the marginalized group to be sort of scapegoated and panicked morally about is, you know, you can think about Hillary Clinton's kind of Black thugs. I think currently the same people are sort of worried very much about these two figures, the sort of predatory trans woman and the sort of mutilated child or something, right? And there are other reasons. I think the crisis of care, throws up these specters. The end of empire panic about futurity expresses itself via, you know, demographic anxieties, right? On the far right, it's replacement theory and white genocide. And, you know, I mean, it's that same anxiety is across the political spectrum, I think. And that sort of demographic anxiety about the survival of America as a settler colony enacts itself, you know, on the bodies of children whose fertility becomes fetishized.
Yeah.
And I mean, what else? You know, capitalism needs to discipline the non-productive and the inadequately or incorrectly reproductive, and, you know, and the non-reproductive. And so this is kind of, yeah, this is part of that. I mean, I'm not doing a great job. I'm just kind of throwing out, like, phenomena that I think are relevant, you know. We are living inside the legacies of the sort of pedophile industrial complex of the 80s, if you know what I mean, right? The really significant sort of reconstruction of the political landscape in the US around the carceral, like, figure of the innocent child, you know, or like the carceralist figure, right? The figure to be protected at all costs on the basis of asexuality and weirdly fertility, right? This is the part that I think people don't get enough about the figure of the sort of cisgender or cissexual child that everybody wants to save right now. It's kind of creepy. It's an avatar of fertility, that child. It's an avatar of the future, not just, you know, in these ways that I think you mentioned in your sort of notes to me before we began this talk, you know, Lee Edelman's book, which is justly criticized, I think, for its sort of slightly unnuanced, you know, opposition to, you know, the maternal or the reproductive or whatever. But, you know, Lee Edelman's book, No Future, Queer Theory and the Death Drive, talks about the fascism of the baby's face, quote unquote, or the way in which all politics with a capital P kind of requires this sort of figure of the child to sort of transmit and defer and displace any possible sort of transformation into the future. But I think, yeah, I think I've been trying to think about whether that's all that's going on. I think very specifically in a time of demographic crisis and sort of weird replacement theory type panic, weirdly, it's literally the sort of genitals and the reproductive organs of literal cis children that become like, yeah, spectrally present at the front and center of so much political discourse. I don't know. How's that? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it is just deeply creepy, you know, like you said, when it's broken down that way, when we're fixating so heavily on the reproductive capability of, in some cases, literal babies, you know, like infants. And it just reifies to me the like very profound extent to which cis heteronormative society just really thinks about children as property. Which is like codified into law too. I don't know. It's just very, very disturbing and creepy.
Yes.
This does. Did you have a further response to that, Sophie or Scott?
If Sophie, if you wanted to say something about that, I could like build on things, but yeah.
No, please.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I was just thinking, like, it's interesting in my studies of like gay liberation stuff from the 70s. You know, like reading Guy Ockingham, and he's like saying that the price for, you know, a certain kind of gay man to get some kinds of rights and acceptance in society would like basically necessitate the casting out of figures like the trans woman and the pedophile. And he had this kind of prescient view of it in the very beginning of gay liberation. And I feel like we're like kind of seeing the culmination of it, but like the way that, as people, the three of us, you know, raised in this like pedophile industrial complex, it's always very strange to me how it like creates this weird situation where children are like unnecessarily sexualized in all these moments where like things don't need to be fraught or like weird at all. And people are like worrying about this stuff. And it's actually, to me, always ends up, and this is, you know, something I'm sure you have a lot to say, is like pointing to like the family as this really, really creepy scenario where there's like parents kind of like obsessing over their children, you know?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. There's so much to say. I'm just worried that if I jump on your points about parental rights, you know, we'll kind of rhizomatically like follow who knows what kinds of paths. Maybe that's fine. Maybe that's fine. I, you know, some of the contradictions and the rate, you know, the very fundamentally racial character of the institution of parenthood, you know, should probably be noted at least in passing. This goes back to sort of elemental Black feminist theorizing around the way in which Black gestators under chattel slavery in the United States were cast out from the domain of dyadic cisgender precisely because they could not be sort of inscribed in the social order as mothers. They were not the mothers in the sense of motherhood, the institution of property, really, of sort of ownership, of parental, you know, ownership over the products of their gestational labor. And that casting out from parentality also meant an ungendering, right? An ungendering of enslaved, you know, racialized, like, Black flesh, to quote Hortense Spillers, right? She uses that language of sort of ungendered flesh. And this is kind of still deeply relevant in a way to the way we, the eugenic entanglements of all mainstream discourse about who should and should not reproduce in the United States today, right? And this is sort of, yeah, it's interesting to think about the intersections between that almost like, yeah, racializing definition of proper and improper parents and this kind of contradiction that we're seeing right now, where the very same politicians who advocate parental rights when it comes to things like white parents on school boards, you know, banning critical race theory or anti-racist materials, they then willingly embrace separating trans kids from their parents. Anyway, I'll pause there.
No, I think that's that's a great transition, and this is something we wanted to talk about. And I think it was really important that you brought up the sort of racialized history of you know, property, and also of the kind of gendering and ungendering according to your like sort of racial positionality of parenthood. Right. So yeah, this is like this is one of the things that's linking the kind of current generic fascist whatever agenda. You brought up critical race theory. We're seeing all the sort of attacks against any education around queerness in whatever form, the access to transition or care around transition for youth in particular, but it's also extending to adults. And then abortion, more recently. And the sort of idea of parental rights seems to be one of the kind of organizing ideas. So if there's more that you wanted to say around that, I'd be interested, just because it feels like such a strange invocation. Also, like the drag shows is a particular kind of focus.
Yeah.
The like youth drag shows is something that like people are getting really worked up about right now.
Oh yes. Oh yes. Yeah. As you say, these links among the prongs of attack. So there's, a kind of successful and well-organized, you know, banning of anti-racism and of queerness appearing in school spaces. Who was the congressman who was sort of brandishing just a couple of days ago, anti-racist baby, the infant's book? There's a real obsession, I think, with the... the idea of the infant, even not just the child, but literally the neonate learning about America's history in school, there's a sort of criminalization, as you say, at the same time of trans affirming childcare and of abortion, of gestational labor stoppages, as I would also sort of encourage us to reframe them, or at least, you know, also think of them as. And I think all of these, as you say, can be linked directly to the project of parental rights. And they reflect specifically a vision of patriarchal, familist authority that cannot be disentangled from whiteness and from a kind of totally triumphalist, flattened ahistoricism, you know, a version of history that is entirely made up. And I think we need to pay more attention to the way that this Republican-allied Christo-fascist series of maneuvers going on all these fronts that you mentioned are part of a project to reinstall the supremacy of the family. And I think I was reading a dialogue between Andrea Long Chu and Paisley Currer in Jewish Currents today. And I think they were right to highlight together the kind of Christo-fascist series of associations, which in a way, you know, I almost want to say they're right. Like, it's annoying to have to constantly almost want to say that our very worst enemies understand the material kind of stakes of the private nuclear household's links to all of these, you know, historical forms of domination, from, you know, enslavement and colonialism to patriarchy and so on. They understand that better than the liberal establishment, you know, they understand the stakes. And I guess Andrea Long Chu and Paisley Kuro were talking about the line of connection in their minds, the Christo-fascists' minds, between abortion, which, you know, disrupts the family, and things like marriage equality or whatever, and the specter of trans freaks molesting your kids in public bathrooms. They are linked in our enemies' minds. They are all assaults on the, I guess Angela Mitropoulos is another theorist I'm thinking of, who I'm unfortunately not as acquainted with as I would like, but I think her theorization of this is probably more and more needed right now as Christo-fascism sort of spirals into more and more power in a way on this territory. She talks about the, you know, the oikos and mm-hmm. the ways in which capital and settler colonialism sort of discipline this sphere via very violent attacks, yeah, on improper bodily pleasures that fall with, you know, outside of the domain of productivity and reproductivity, so-called. I don't know. Yeah, that's you know, yeah, that's why all of these different fronts at the same time, I guess. Mm-hmm. Although they're, as I say, they're insufficiently linked, I think, in the mainstream conversation.
Absolutely.
If you would like to support The Final Straw, you can subscribe to our podcast via various platforms, follow and share our materials online, as well as give us feedback via the links at tfsr.wtf/tree, as in Linktree. To support our transcription work and wider project, you can subscribe to us via patreon.com/tfsr. You can also buy some merch or find donation methods at tfsr.wtf/support.
Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
I know the kind of pain you're feeling, Alex. I once had it myself.
You some kind of doctor?
No, Alex. I am Magneto, and I have come to offer you sanctuary.
Hello, this is our jingle for our podcast, The Grounded Futures Show.
This is the show where we discuss topics ranging from climate change to identity to how youth can gain new skills to thrive amid current and ongoing disasters that we are collectively facing. We are your hosts, one Gen Z Liam and one Gen X Carla. And we think we all deserve to thrive now and not in some distant utopian future.
Yeah, but that's in the future. Oh, I hate the future.
Yeah, we're with Bolin. Grounded Futures is a larger project, so check that out over at groundedfutures.com.
Hi, you're listening to The Final Straw Radio, and today we're talking with Sophie Lewis about the state's attack against access to transition care and access to abortion care.
When you were talking and using the, I think, very correct framework of like Christo-fascism to kind of like politically frame like the shift or whatever, like the dominant shift that's going on right now, I couldn't really help but thinking about like how The Handmaid's Tale is used to kind of describe this and sort of the shortcomings of that analysis. Do you have like any ideas about that?
Well, you know, it's actually interesting because I think you probably know that I had for several years, a real bee in my bonnet about The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's fertility apocalypse, or sterility apocalypse, rather. You know, but I want to actually say, but I'm beginning to sort of think that I might have almost gone a tiny bit too far. There might have been an element of overreach in my annoyance, because Angela Mitropoulos pulled me up a little bit on this, because, you know, I think I'm broadly speaking right, and I'm also not the first to say it, but, you know, beginning in about 2017, I began to sort of lose my temper at, yeah, the handmade mania of liberal feminism. And so I actually wrote several pieces, and there's a bit in the very beginning of Full Surrogacy Now where I express this distemper about the bizarre psychic undertow of handmade mania. This, you know, I sort of say provocatively that it's a utopia, not a dystopia, in a sense, because what all the people cosplaying as handmaids in Gilead are kind of I think, unconsciously acting out is a desire for this world where womanhood has been flattened back into pure gestationality. And that wouldn't that be nice? Because then you wouldn't have, you know, class conscious or decolonial or trans or black feminists critiquing you all the time. because as the op-eds kept saying, we are literally living in Gilead. You know, if that were true, then, you know, then yeah, then well, you know, then you would be as a cis, you know, pregnant white woman like Elizabeth Moss in the Hulu adaptation, the very most oppressed subject of America, right? And it's like, okay, that actually happened. You know, it happened to enslaved black women. You know, forced surrogacy is not made up. And, you know, to some extent, Margaret Atwood was constantly saying that. She was like, oh, everything in my dystopias has sort of happened before. But that's very much not how it's taken up, right? It's not taken up as an anti-racist consciousness. It's not taken up in a way that connects to reproductive justice struggles or centers, you know, the sorts of reproductive justice concerns of organizers from the South. You know, anyway, you know, yeah. But I will say, I think I got a bit carried away, and I sort of felt like I had to have a conclusion and a flourish where I said, and I'm paraphrasing from memory now, but, you know, the thing that really, you know, is still number one as an enemy in women's lives is capitalism. It's not theocratic fascists with guns, you know? And I sort of feel now that Angela might have been right, that there's no need to downplay the danger of the Christo-fascists, you know, in order to criticize the sort of deracialized slave narrative that is The Handmaid's Tale. Okay, I'll leave it there.
Well, you know, I guess I think I love the way that you analyze that, and but I see what you're saying, and my follow-up to that is like, okay, going also back to the family. So we were like in the last however many decades in a place where people are living perhaps less and less. And I guess what I mean people is like people typically within the dominant form, let's say in the kind of like more represented white suburban situations are like living less and less in the kind of typical nuclear family. And yet the like idea of the family hasn't really been knocked down as a kind of controlling image, like especially I think within like TV, like sitcoms, even if it's like a work show, it's like it's a family structure, right? It's like everywhere, but we're kind of not living in those things. And likewise, I think with the issues around abortion, there's this idea that we're kind of like progressing away from these things that have been, you know, really oppressive. Mm-hmm. And I feel like even for leftists and anarchists, there's like a sort of maybe like a blind spot or an unwillingness to let go of the kind of roots of our society that we live in that is structuring all this kind of oppression that we're living in now because of this like faith in a kind of progress that we've like made. We've made some strides away from this thing. And the Christian fascist thing really points out to me like what we're seeing right now is a minority group taking power, right? And the system that is in place that ostensibly holds checks against them is like the people who are inhabiting those positions are completely unwilling to check them. They're letting it happen, right? All the people like, you know, like the president, like they're not doing anything. So on one level, it's like Christian fascism seems ridiculous, but like we're literally seeing these people like seize power and no one is really doing anything about it. And so I can see also why that's utopian to be like, oh, we finally understand what woman is. It's like reproduction or whatever, right? But yeah, I don't know. Maybe you have some thoughts about the kind of progress narrative around also like the kind of like way that facts are negating that too.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. The liberal mainstream is almost capable of noticing that there's or saying, you know, that there's a civil war right around the corner, but they literally do not intend to fight in it. It is so cognitively maddening. It's like, it's almost as though, yeah, that liberal establishment doesn't intend to do a single thing, just as it didn't in order to defend abortion, because it sort of imagined that, yeah, its Republican dancing partners would sort of kind of play fair against all evidence to the contrary. No, progress narratives are an epistemic kind of canker, like a blight, like a real, like it, and it's so difficult to completely get rid of, I think, even, you know, even when one knows better. It's like we're just swimming in this idea of history as progress, mm-hmm. and you can never overstate the importance of sort of unthinking it, unpicking it. You know, I think it's important to, what can I say that's sort of helpful against that, right? Like, especially in this moment. I mean, it almost gives me hope that there is so much rage right now against the Democrats and their non-response to the striking down of Roe. And I think what could be done is to frame the fight back in terms of very much sort of politics, not ethics, you know, mass gestational labor power, prol power, not sort of individual personal freedom in a sense, and not individual tragedies, and also not, you know, these terrible sort of spectacularizing tactics that some pro-choicers are using right now, where they're brandishing kind of blood-stained white pants and coat hangers and talking about we won't go back, and insisting that, you know, quote, thousands will die in backstreet abortions. Like, you know, why is that the imaginary? It's not actually helpful. Like, we are actually in a historically different era. They can surveil and police and incarcerate, and we need to get really good at organizing against that and de-arresting people and blocking their ability to charge people. And we need to get really good at evading and, yeah, kind of operating undercover. But it's also really important to, you know, think about the time we are in and the future we could build, rather than, you know, I feel like we won't go back imagines that, you know, the reproductive status quo ante was sort of okay. Like it was okay, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. I mean, abortions are overwhelmingly safe today, right? Mm-hmm. That's like, regardless of whether or not they're legal. And yeah, I just sort of, I feel that there's this bizarre, almost like attachment to a kind of Margaret Atwood flavored catastrophe. Sort of, does that make sense? We're literally gonna all die because of the abortions themselves. Like, no, actually mm-hmm. that's not what's primarily gonna happen. It's much worse in a sense. Well, okay, mm-hmm. sorry. I don't mean, I'm not saying incarceration is worse than death, but the real story that this is a prison abolition story, right? Mm-hmm. Guess what? Right, you know, yet again, this is an abolitionist lesson, right? The problem of, you know, abortion being criminalized is a criminalization problem, an over criminalization problem. It's a prison industrial complex problem. It's a police abolition problem. You know what I mean? But I'm not sure that really links to your progress narrative point, but I guess it links it to one of the big movements that has, you know, swept the whatever, the quote unquote national conversation in recent years, right? Which is like, one thing has to change, which is everything. You know, it's not a question of making little meliorative steps towards a better world.
I think that's really important what you said, and I just wanted to pick up on it, if that's okay. The sort of the way that these laws are being crafted, that is increasing surveillance, increasing criminalization, increasing the possibilities of incarceration. So there's like increased state power there, which is maybe also why the kind of liberals and Democrats in power are like not, you know, so against it, because it's a boon for the state. But then the other thing that I'm thinking about is how all of these laws are deputizing, you know, citizens or whatever to be informants, right? And yes. And that also to me speaks to the kind of nascent fascism, where that leads to, like, you know, vigilante groups or paramilitary formations of people like seeking out who's doing this, right? Or like crossing state yeah. lines to track people down. So I just thought that was really important that you brought up the kind of the way that the criminalization aspect of it works. And it shifts the focus around the kind of liberal reaction of like, of performing yeah. grief, I guess, around something that's not actually live for them in the moment, too. Yeah. So I just wanted mm-hmm. to pull that out. I guess on the other side of the progress narrative, there's the sort of this, the long-running anarchist or anarchistic critiques of legalizing abortion because of the mm-hmm. way that incorporated the sort of grassroots formations of like caring for gestators and childbirth and ending childbirth outside of professionalization or outside of institutionalization, which are dominated by men in particular, patriarchal power structures. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about any of that or what we could learn from that perspective now in response to this, which feels so upsetting, but like maybe there's like other ways, avenues of response.
Yes, yes, yes. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the fact is so much of Turtle Island has been operating in a post-Roe reality, right, for so long. I don't know how much that is really, you know, real to people, right? But we've been post-Roe, you know, in a combined and uneven way for some time, right?
Absolutely.
This is sort of the zombie kind of lag of it becoming, you know, law. I think people understand in the places where it's been de facto post-Roe for years and years that abortion care happens outside of professional structures and independently of experts. And I think there is also quite a wide understanding that Roe absolutely sucked mm-hmm. in the first place. Like, even before the Hyde Amendment gutted it, and even before the Casey ruling gutted it still further, Roe versus Wade absolutely sucked. And to the extent that it even legalized abortion, which we have to say is not, it's not even really clear that it did that. It sort of legalized a woman's or a family's sort of right to have a private conversation mm-hmm. with a healthcare provider or whatever, right? But we have to ask ourselves, what good is legalization and why do we want that? What, you know, you call it an anarchist critique of the kind of legalizing of abortion. And it absolutely is that. It is also actually a critique that used to be, you know, quite common across the board in the 70s and the 60s, really, like that achieved this Pyrrhic victory of Roe in 73. What if we want, you know, laws off our bodies and indeed an end to all laws, right? Rather than laws that legalize anything we might do with our laboring uteri. And what if we want the, you know, repeal of all abortion laws, not just the bad ones? And I mean, as you know, in terms of the mainstream conversation, for sure, this perspective has been pretty widely lost over the course of the last four decades, but it's not really just a post-Roe critique, I think you called it. I think it was actually primarily a pre-Roe critique, you know? And I like to call it gestational decrim, right? They used to say off our backs, etc., right? The idea being we get the state completely like off and out of our flesh, not just its punitive functions, but also its supposedly benign regulatory functions, right? And the term gestational decrim is basically, I mean, that's something I floated. I don't know if it's going to take off, but, you know, it's an analogy to the sex work liberation movement's call for decrim, as you well know, right? Comrades have sort of tirelessly made the distinction between partial legalization and regulation, the so-called Nordic model, which is terrible for workers, and full decriminalization, right?
So, like, on the topic of operating sublegally or whatever, there, as many listeners probably know, is a group called Jane's Revenge who is seemingly attempting to like destabilize pro-life or forced birth infrastructures. Could you talk about that a little bit and like, well, you know, just like talk about what's been in the news and also like some of your thoughts on how it's been received and how we might like think about it in a more productive way?
Yeah. Okay, so I wish I had every single fact about the, you know, Jane's revenge at my fingertips. I'm just going to talk sort of in generalities. In the aftermath of the Supreme Court leak striking down Roe, you know, a shadowy, you know, anarchist network calling itself Jane's Revenge was reported on a lot. You know, striking via, you know, graffiti actions and allegedly also, you know, a Molotov cocktail, some window smashing. The graffiti tag that was used in various locales, and as you mentioned, the targets, Jane's Revenge was targeting CPCs, you know, crisis pregnancy centers, which are fake abortion clinics that are funded by the far right to sort of psychologically guilt and dissuade people from getting abortion care. Anyway, and there was sort of reporting on Jane's Revenge that their tag was, if abortions aren't safe, then neither are you. If abortions aren't safe, then you aren't either. You know, that was their sort of slogan. I have to say, I sort of love it.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to an episode of the Final Straw Radio podcast. If you want to hear the rest, head to thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And as always, we'll leave you with some news you can use. The community group Solidarity Across Borders is organizing a march in support of non-status migrants in Montreal and across Canada. The demonstrators will be meeting at Place Émile de Gamelin on Sunday, July 17th at 2 p.m. You can find out more on their Instagram page, ssf.sab, or on the website solidarityacrossborders.org. And the nonprofit blood collection agency, Emma Quebec, is calling on more Black people to donate blood. Most of the 200 Quebecers with sickle cell anemia and who need regular blood transfusions are Black. It is less risky for regular recipients if their donors are more genetically similar. For more information on how to donate, visit hema/quebec.qc.ca. And the Diving Bell Social Club is organizing a musical fundraising show for the National Network of Abortion Funds. All proceeds will go to the network, which fights to remove barriers to abortion access across the U.S. That's next Wednesday, July 20th at 8 p.m. The record label Hot Tramp has more information on their Facebook page. And this weekend, the Grove Campus Collective is hosting a live spoken word poetry show. It takes place at Montreal Improv on Sunday, July 17th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. You can find out more about this event and the rest of the Grove Campus Art Series on Instagram at Grove Campus. And today marks the return of NDG's weekly Neighborhood Farmers Market. Every Friday from 1 to 6 p.m., you can buy fresh, local produce at the corner of Monkland and Old Orchard near the Monkland Tavern. And if you live in another borough, look up your local's farmers market. There are at least 14 in Montreal this summer. Search for Montreal blog, Farmers Market. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Joelle Salmadal, Cillian Davenport-Brown, Tess Pilkington, Prajnal Malik, Moisha Mori, Ree Maraji, Michael Edelson, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Hour Montreal, or connect with us on Facebook, search for CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe, coming up next.
X-Files. 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 Radio.